Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Globalization is possibly the most important economic phenomenon of the past several decades. Opening borders, increasing trade, and deepening integration has transformed our economies, our societies, and our politics. Globalization has changed what the establishment supports. The reaction against globalization has transformed those standing against the establishment. But there's a world of difference between Donald Trump's and Bernie Sanders' critiques of globalization. And those who have concerns about it do so for different reasons, building different alliances as they work to implement, reform, or roll back globalization. Anthea Roberts and Nicholas Lamp, authors of Six Faces of Globalization, Who Wins, Who Loses, and Why It Matters, published by Harvard University Press, looks more closely at these debates, building out distinct narratives that classify how we should think about the politics of globalization and how different political movements understand who wins from the phenomenon. Everyone, a few, or nobody at all. Anthea Roberts is professor in the School of Regulation and Global Governance at Australian National University and author of the prize-winning Is International Law International? Nicholas Lamp is associate professor in the Faculty of Law at Queen's University, Ontario. Before joining Queen's University, he worked as a dispute settlement lawyer at the World Trade Organization. Today, Anthea, Nicholas, and I will talk about the politics of globalization, the arguments used to support it, and the stories used to criticize it. We'll explore some of the interesting intersections between these arguments and where we think the politics of globalization might go from here. So thank you to the both of you for joining me on the Asian Review of Books podcast. Perhaps let's kind of start with setting the scene a bit. Globalization, I think, in the 90s, maybe early 2000s, was seen as very much an inevitable economic phenomenon. You had all these politicians come out and say, it's inevitable, it'll definitely happen. Everyone at least appeared to be with the program, let's say. But now, of course, it's much more contested. There's lots more, it seems like there's a lot more reaction to it, a lot more political movements against it. Yes, they were always there, but now they seem a lot more, quote unquote, mainstream. So I guess kind of to start, when it comes to the politics of globalization, what happened and why do they seem more contested now than they have in the past?
Yeah, so there have always been protests against globalization. We had, of course, in 1999, the famous Battle of Seattle. But I think the point at which criticism of globalization went mainstream was around the 2015-2016 mark. So in Europe, you had these massive protests against trade agreements that were being discussed at the time between the European Union and the United States. And then, of course, in 2016, you had the Brexit vote and the election of Donald Trump. And so that was really the moment at which we felt that the ground was shifting, that this old establishment consensus in favor of globalization that you were talking about was really shaking. And what interested us at the beginning of this project was to understand these different critiques that were put forward by those in Europe, because we felt that some, especially the left-wing critiques that we saw in Europe, proposed by NGOs and by labor unions, had very little in common necessarily with what Donald Trump was saying or that Brexiteers were arguing in the UK. And so the origin of this project was to try to take a step back from these very heated and very emotional debates and to try to understand what was actually the critique of globalization and how was the establishment reacting to it.
And I guess I'll just add one thing to that. So thank you very much for having us on the show. It's really interesting to do this, particularly with the Asia Review of Books. And that's because this book really charts the major pushback that we've seen within the Western debates. But of course, the Western debates are not necessarily representative of the whole world. And I think you actually find different levels of pushback against economic globalization in different parts of the world. And I think there's still a lot more enthusiasm about economic globalization in Asia than what we're actually seeing in some of the Western debates at the moment. And I think part of what's also led to this in the Western debates, even if it sort of came to a tipping point in that 2015, 2016, I think it traces some much longer term changes that were sort of building up over time, including things like the change in geopolitical power and economic power between the West and the rest, or the US and China. And they're also part of the drivers behind why we see the pushback and why it seems to be felt most acutely in the West at the moment.
So the book talks about narratives of globalization. And I guess kind of why use that term in particular, and why does understanding them as narratives, what does that help us as observers, as analysts, to kind of understand about the politics of globalization?
So I think we have to talk a little bit about our professional backgrounds here. So neither of us is an economist. We are both trained in law and also a bit in social sciences, but we're not doing quantitative research. And so what we were observing in the early reactions to the critiques of globalization was this very confident dismissal of these critiques by what we call the economic establishment and the economics profession in particular, essentially saying to Trump and the Brexiteers, you're economically illiterate, you don't know what you're talking about. And we felt that was counterproductive and was not really moving us forward. But of course, we didn't really want to confront, it was not so much that we wanted to confront the empirical arguments that the establishment was making. Our point was a broader one, that this is a broader debate that is not just about who's empirically right. It's also about whose values do we hold, and what kind of values do we hold? What do we consider important? And that doesn't really is not really that something that you can assess and discuss if you simply look at empirical questions. You have to try to understand the broader stories that people are taking are telling. We have to understand what people care about. And so it was a very deliberate decision on our part to not say, okay, who's right about who wins and loses from globalization? That's not the question that we are asking. It was a decision to say, okay, what are the different narratives that people are telling about globalization? Because that allowed us to essentially put the empirical questions to the side for a moment and actually ask, okay, see, what is the story that they're telling? What are the normative preferences that are expressed here? What are the values that people hold? And talk about these different perspectives without necessarily getting into the empirical questions of who's right and who's wrong.
Can I also just add on this that I think that one of the aspects of economic globalization is that it's a really complex phenomenon. It's very hard to get your head around it. And the way that people seek to understand complex phenomena is through simplifying stories. And the reality is that people often have different simplifying stories. And so even the question of what is the empirical test, so the economists had simplified the story that they told, and we will describe that in a second about the establishment narrative. And on some of the empirical questions in their simplified story, they were right. But their simplified story made certain assumptions that you could look primarily at economic gain, that you could look primarily at an aggregate national level, and that many of the challenging stories are challenged by looking at different levels of analysis or different units, be they sort of non-economic values or what happens when you look at the effects of trade, not on a national level, but on a disaggregated regional level. Many of those sort of ways that sort of push us to think and ask different questions empirically actually begin in different understandings of what is important and different stories. And so it's quite often the case that these are often kind of early warning signs about something that hasn't been fully considered, because every single story tends to be partial and it directs your attention to certain things and not other things. And this is an early way that you start to access that multifaceted nature of a complex problem like globalization.
So let's start with that establishment view. What does it focus on, and kind of what particular political grouping supported the supported and still supports the establishment view of globalization?
I think this would be a good one for Nicholas to start with, given his background at the WTO.
Well, I would say the establishment view was essentially the view held by mainstream parties in most Western democracies for the past 20 years. And it's also the view that is supported by by international institutions such as the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, the IMF, that are the guardians of the international economic order. And the gist of the argument that these institutions make is that globalization has the potential to make us all better off because it increases the size of the pie. And then, yeah, there are tricky political questions about that pie is then divided. But the basic truth is that we can all gain through international trade, through rising productivity, through greater specialization. And if we accept that basic starting point, then it's a no-brainer that we have to eliminate obstacles to international trade, that we have to liberalize international trade and services and international financial flows. The establishment narrative does recognize that in the short term, there will be losers. There will be losers in certain locations, but it has a very clear message to those losers, and that is to adjust, right? And an important argument that you often see in publications that were put out, for example, by the World Trade Organization, the IMF, and the World Bank after the election of Donald Trump is this emphasis on, first, that it's not just trade that is causing disruptions, it's also technological change. And the only sound answer is to help people adjust through active labor market policies, by bolstering the safety net, the domestic loop. And there's another message here, which is more implicit than explicit, but which is that addressing these distributive concerns that arise from globalization is really a task for domestic policy. So it's almost the international organizations like throwing up their hands a little bit to saying that, well, we can't really do anything about it. Like, if you mess up at the domestic level, that's not really our fault. So the important thing that you have to do domestically is to make sure that the pie is evenly distributed and that the losers get the support that will help them to be better off in the long term.
And so then after the establishment view, kind of the everyone wins narrative, you then kind of go down to the next set of narratives in your book, which is where the argument is not everyone wins. People lose, and they lose kind of permanently, as opposed to a losing where they could be compensated. And perhaps let's start with the left-wing and right-wing populist narratives of globalization, which you in your book say are distinct. I guess, in short, what makes them distinct? What divides these two narratives about globalization?
Well, I guess the first point to make about that is what unites them and then what divides them. So we've used the word populism for both, and that's controversial. You could name them different things, but in this one, we've sort of named them by their slightly sort of stronger figures on either side. And what they have in common with the populist agenda is an idea of a distrust for the elite. And so what Nicholas has just described is a very strong establishment position that was associated with the elite that sort of said free trade and economic globalization is a good thing, and it's a good thing for everybody. And both of these are ones where there is a greater sense that there are the masses that have been let down by the elite. And that's the sort of essence of the populist reaction. But the populist reaction is different depending on its left-wing and its right-wing variation. So the left-wing variation is really the one that's typified by or sort of personified by some of the characters you said in your introduction, Sanders and AOC, also Elizabeth Warren, which really sees this as a vertical problem that the rich has pulled away ahead of the rest, and it's hollowed out the middle class and left a sort of larger service class below that's really struggling, the poor and the working class. And so they see it as what we would think of as sort of a vertical hostility of the elite having taken a disproportionate share of the winnings and not done the kind of redistribution that was assumed to happen in the establishment narrative. What we see in the right-wing populist narrative is something a bit different. They are also distrustful of the elite, but they are distrustful not because they say that the elite has amassed all the wealth and power to themselves, leaving these hourglass economies behind, but because the elite has failed to protect the domestic population, and particularly the working class population, from an external threat. And here we see this really personified by people like Trump, who really saw the people that had done the wrong thing here is that your jobs had been shipped from good manufacturing working class communities in America to places like Mexico and to China, which really benefited the workers in those countries, but at the expense of the workers in the developed states. And so there was a distrust of the feckless elite that had entered into the kind of trade deals that allowed that kind of offshoring of jobs to happen. But here, the major hostility is not so much just vertical, but is very strongly horizontal between different countries. And that also then ties in with an important cultural point, that the left-wing one tends to be much more of a sort of a cosmopolitan, we're in this together, whereas the right-wing one is often associated not just with the concern about declining manufacturing and the Rust Belt and some sort of sense that America or other countries like that have been ripped off and taken advantage of by countries like China and Mexico. But it's also not just about this sort of offshoring of jobs, but the onshoring of immigrants. Because one of the ways that we see this happening very strongly, and this is not just in the US, but particularly strongly in Europe, is a concern about the onshoring of immigrants. And that can be for economic reasons of they might be coming to steal my job, or they might be sitting on welfare and getting welfare benefits that have come from our community. But often underneath it is also a very strong cultural sense of wanting to stick to some sort of more homogenous sort of ethnicity, or to traditional cultural values, or traditional sort of community, sort of rural values. And that's something that's quite different to what you see in the left-wing critique. I should also say that there are different variations of the left-wing critique. Often on the Democrat side, there's much more of a sense of the problem is the 1%, and we, the 99%, are together against the 1%, which are the super billionaires. Whereas what bleeds into some of the more right-wing approach is a different divide, which is the 20% versus the 80%. That's often an educational divide, which says that, sure, the 1% may have done particularly well, but the very educated, college-educated classes have also done well in economic globalization.
So I do want to get into some of the interesting intersections between these narratives, but we should probably explain your other narratives before we do that. So there are kind of two other narratives that kind of are in this kind of middle section where the differences between who wins, who loses are played out. And those are the corporate power narrative and the geoeconomic narrative. I wonder if you might kind of explain those before we kind of start getting to some of the interesting intersections in the politics.
Great. I'll let Anthea talk about the geoeconomic narrative, where she has been, I think, one of the most expert commentators. The corporate power narrative is a tricky one, because we've been criticized quite a bit that it's not that different from the left-wing populist narrative. But we do see a difference. And the difference is mainly that the corporate power narrative takes a transnational perspective. And I just want to give you one example. If we compare the critique of the offshoring of job that we hear from the likes of Donald Trump, that is the image that Trump paints is that the developing countries are winning, whereas developed countries are losing, and particularly the workers in developed countries. The corporate power narrative tells a different story. It says, well, actually, it's workers in both countries, both in developing countries, are losing, and it's the corporations that are winning. And the exhibit A for that narrative is what happens to jobs when they are moved from developed countries to developing countries. Because what the narrative points out, is that what was a good job with benefits and high wages in the developed country becomes a really low-paying job in the developing country, and the surplus that is generated in the process is appropriated by the corporation. Of course, the establishment response to that is often going to be, well, the workers in developing countries are less productive, and so the lower wages simply reflect their lower productivity. But if you look at, for example, Mexico, we see that since NAFTA was concluded, productivity of Mexican workers has been rising consistently, whereas the real wages have actually not gone up. Right? And so that's one of the clearest examples that it's actually the corporations that are mostly benefiting from international trade and not so much the workers in developing countries. And that also leads to a very different perspectives about the kind of politics that we need in order to respond to globalization. And so there's an attempt to ally workers in different countries to each other. So during the NAFTA renegotiations, we had Jerry Diaz, the boss of the Unifor Union, traveling down to Mexico to say, we are with you. We want you to have higher wages, because then we are all going to be better off. You're going to be able to buy the cars that we produce. And so everybody's going to benefit. And so he was really emphasizing that the fight of the Canadian workers was not with the Mexican workers. it was they were collectively fighting against the corporations. And so, yes, there are, of course, strong parallels here to the left-wing populist narrative. But by bringing in this transnational dimension, we do see a somewhat distinct features in this narrative.
And I guess then I'll come in on the geoeconomic narrative. So I think if the corporate power is a bit more on the left side, the geoeconomic, I think, started out a bit more on the right side. It was something that became much more prevalent through Trump, though it's one that I think has become a bit more bipartisan, particularly in the US and increasingly in some other Western countries as well. But to me, it's a very good illustration of the way in which your unit of analysis changes in the different narratives. So we've heard, for example, about the left-wing populist narrative, which has a unit of analysis of looking at sort of class. We've heard with the corporate power one, where you look at, like, you focus in on corporations and how they may be the real beneficiaries here. And what you see in the geoeconomic narrative is a shift to thinking about sort of countries as a whole, but particularly thinking about great power competition, because this has been very strongly driven originally by competition and rivalry between the US and China. And there what we see is that I think many in the US would say that both China and the US both gained from economic globalization in absolute terms, but that China has gained in proportional terms much more. And it has used that to close the gap on the United States. And that's closing the gap economically. It's also closing the gap technologically. They've become much stronger technologically. And this is creating geopolitical concerns and security and geostrategic concerns for the US. And so this is the narrative that you'd start to see the pushback against major Chinese companies like Huawei, and saying, no, there's a sort of a geopolitical or a security reason why we don't want to have Huawei in these different places. It's what underscores the concern about supply chain reliance on a strategic a competitor. So the US wanting to secure its supply chains to not be as heavily reliant on China. It's what you see in the increase in investment screening, the use of security exceptions in trade. So it's got that strong geopolitical security inflection to it.
So last but not least, there are six narratives. We've talked about five of them. And so I want to make sure we ask about the very last one, the global threats narrative, which I think answers the question of who wins, who loses from globalization, to basically answer everyone loses. But could you kind of get into this final narrative, kind of complete your set of six, and then we can start getting into some of the interesting intersections between them?
Sure. So you're quite right. We almost think of it like a diamond. So you've got on top, you've got the win-win establishment narrative. In the middle layer, you've got the win-lose ones, but different ideas about who wins and who loses. And on the bottom, we've got this idea that maybe we all lose. And this one, people would know most strongly through probably the sustainability narrative, which is concerned about things like climate change. So at the same stage as you've seen through economic globalization and capitalism, you've seen this huge increase in productivity. We've also seen this huge increase in carbon emissions. And a lot of that has also been accelerated through economic globalization as some of the Western production and consumption approaches have been spread around the world. And so the sustainability narrative says that actually we need to radically rethink our approach to our economies if we want to survive and thrive within the limits of our planet. And while the sustainability is the one that has been sort of around the most as an example of this global threat that we're all in this together and that our current ways of doing things are unsustainable, it's also been the basis of what you start to see in the COVID-19 situation, where again, we're starting to see a global threat, something that we're all in together to some extent, but it's one where it's exacerbated by economic globalization. And so you can see with the COVID-19 threat that the way in which it traveled throughout the world was very strongly based on physical movements of people flying between different countries and shipping, but also the supply chain shock that followed was very much one based on economic globalization. And here the narrative that we start to see coming out in response is not so much a sustainability narrative, but a resilience narrative, which is that we have become too interconnected with too many places, too many long-taught efficient supply chains, And so now what we need to do is recalibrate the balance and become more resilient. And so it's these sort of resilience and sustainability narratives that are really sort of saying that we're all in a boat together, where we need to step back from our current approaches to our economies and our current approaches to economic globalization, or else we're at risk that everybody will lose.
So you can already start to see in kind of in explaining these narratives where there are alignments, where there are intersections. I mean, obviously, for example, there are alignments between left-wing populist and corporate power. There are alignments between right-wing populist and geoeconomic. There are alignments in all over the place. It's also interesting to note where you might not see intersections, or where intersections are easier than others. For example, I think there's much more alignment between coming looking from the outside. There seems to be more alignment between the two wings of the populist views in Europe, say, than in the United States, where I think there are other parts of those political wings that make alignments between these two sides more difficult. Namely, I think, as you note, the more cosmopolitan, immigrant-friendly sides of the of U.S. politics. But again, I guess kind of add to ask a broad question. How do you see these narratives intersect? How do they intersect differently in different places? And are there any kind of interesting examples of these intersections you've seen in kind of in developing this classification?
So I think one of the ones that I found really interesting in doing this was that I had always assumed that the sustainability narrative was more of a left-wing narrative. And so I was used to places like the US, where you would see something the New Deal approaches, the Green New Deal approaches, which really fuse some of your inequality concerns with your climate change concerns. And I think there's often an assumption in the US that the reaction of some of the right-wing approaches to climate change are reactions of climate denialism. And if only we could convince them of the science, then they will all come around and realize that we're all in this together and we need to protect against it. One of the things I found really interesting in Europe was the overlap of some of the right-wing populist approaches with the sustainability approaches. And so, for example, in Austria, you saw a coalition of the Green Party and the Conservative Party, so two different types of conservative, but in a different sort of way, where part of the underlying assumption is that actually, if we want to protect against the planet, or we want to protect where we are, we might need to throw up our borders in various ways in order to stop the flow of immigration and strike deals on climate change. And so I think that's a really interesting example of a kind of alliance that we haven't seen as much. The other place that we're seeing this at the moment is with the semiconductor shortage. And there we're seeing a really interesting overlap between a protectionist narrative that would say, bring the manufacturing back home, a resilience narrative that would say, make sure that your manufacturing is diversified across different countries so you don't have excessive reliance in a particular place, and a geoeconomic narrative that says, make sure that you don't have reliance on your strategic competitor, and so make sure that China is out of the supply chains. And so all three of these overlap with a sort of sense of the importance of doing more domestic manufacturing of semiconductors in places like the US, but they also split in various ways. So for example, all the debates at the moment about ally shoring and whether or not you could create supply chains just among your allies, that sounds relatively good if you're in the resilience category or in the geoeconomic category, because you're trying to get either greater resilience or resilience with your allies and cutting out China. But it doesn't sound good if your motivation is protectionist, because you don't want good manufacturing jobs brought back to your allies. You want them brought back home to yourself, to your own country. And so by using these different narratives, we've started in various policy areas to think about where are their overlaps and where are their disconnects, because they often give us a bit of a sense of where some policy formations might happen or some alliances might happen going forward.
I just wonder if I can add to that and to give a very concrete example. So trade is really one area where we see lots of overlaps between the different narratives, which might be quite surprising. But if you look at the United States, for example, trade policy is one of the areas where we have a lot of bipartisan consensus. And just to give you a sense of how these narratives play out in a particular negotiation, if we go back to the renegotiation of the NAFTA agreement, under Trump, the Trump administration came in with a very strong demand that the manufacturing jobs had to come back to the United States. And the way they wanted to implement that was by creating a requirement that 50% of any car by value had to be made in the United States in order to qualify for duty-free entry into the United States. That was, of course, that was something that was unacceptable for Mexico and for Canada. But what happened in the course of negotiation is that this requirement was changed in a way that made it acceptable to the proponents of the corporate power narrative. And the way it was changed was to say, instead of saying 50% of the car has to be made in the United States, it was changed to a requirement that 40% of the car had to be made by workers making at least $16 an hour. And it's pretty clear why this suddenly became more of a basis for consensus. But first, of course, it didn't exclude Canada anymore. Canada would also has relatively high wages, so it would also be benefiting from this requirement. But even organized labor in Mexico could tell a story well that this will give an incentive to companies to raise wages in Mexico, right? And so it kind of married the concerns of the protectionists, which was to bring back jobs to the high wage countries, with the concern of the right of the corporate power narrative, which was to raise the wages of workers everywhere. And even though proponents of the protectionists and of the corporate power narratives may have agreed to that that requirement for different reason, it provided a basis for consensus. And so this was a really interesting intersection between the narrative where an overlap provided the basis for such an incompletely theorized agreement between the proponents of different narratives.
So I think a lot of our conversation about globalization kind of hinges around the conversation in Western countries, the United States and Europe and Australia, New Zealand. But I guess, do you have a sense of what non-Western societies are thinking about globalization? Do you see the same narratives come to the fore, or maybe the balance between the narratives is different and kind of outside of Western countries? I mean, I note, for example, just to kind of bring in some examples here, it's true that globalization has been very helpful in terms of bringing up incomes, manufacturing, moving to Asia. But it's also true that, especially recently, China has made a lot of noise about concerns about international influence affecting, you know, society, threats to changing the, I guess we can say, like, the character in society. So some of the same arguments are coming through in Asian politics as well when it comes to globalization. So I guess kind of we can have a, do you have a sense of kind of what, of how these narratives are playing out outside of the West?
So this is a super interesting question. And in fact, the last book I wrote was about whether international law was international. And it was particularly tracking the different approaches and understandings of different communities of international lawyers, including some in decidedly outside the West in China and Russia and some within the West. And so it's something I'm quite acutely conscious of, that you often do get very different narratives coming up. We focused here on the Western debate because we saw that as being the place where there was the strongest pushback against economic globalization happening. But we see many of the same narratives also playing out in a variety of other countries. So you see the same struggles between some of the sort of establishment pro-economic globalization approaches in China and some of the left-wing ones that are really concerned about the increase of inequality that's come, and some of the security-based ones that are worried about US influence, particularly on anything to do with the internet. So you can definitely see within other countries some of these narratives playing out. But what we also thought was that within the Western debates there were often what we called blind spots and biases, where certain narratives that had stronger traction in some other parts of the world either got less traction or were looked at from a different angle. So let me give you just two examples of those. The first example would be about blind spots. So I think a lot of the Western debates at the moment almost assume that the losers of economic globalization are the, for example, workers in manufacturing towns and who have been sort of left behind. But of course, there's a much longer critique about economic globalization as being a method of neocolonial power, that first these Western countries colonized and took many of the resources from places like Africa, and then even once colonization was finished, they effectively continued this through their transnational companies. So there's a long historical neo-colonial narrative that's much more critical. And you also have not just that some countries were sort of pillaged previously, but you also have some areas and some groups and some countries that feel like they've been very left behind by economic globalization. So the extraordinary rises we've seen in Asia are not matched by extraordinary rises so far in some parts of Africa, and we still have the bottom billion, for example. And I think that part of the narrative is not a complete blind spot in the Western debates, but hasn't got nearly as much attention. If you think about the elephant graph, for example, you don't see nearly as much focus on the tail of the elephant as you do on the trunk of the elephant, which is where the West is. But what we also see is in a variety of other ones, particularly when we're dealing with winners and losers, there are sort of two different sides to the story, and different media environments privilege different sides of the story. So for example, to pick up on the example that you had given, in the West, we would see that sort of strong right-wing protectionist of Rust Belt and communities having been left behind. That's the story of economic globalization and the redistribution of manufacturing told from the perspective of the loser of those jobs. But the Asia rising narrative and the rise of the middle class and the rise of living standards and the bringing people out of poverty that we see so strongly in the more positive approaches in Asia, that's actually telling the same story, but from the opposite perspective from the winners of that. And I think we can see something similar happening in the geoeconomic domain. So the geoeconomic domain takes a security threat from a rising China and sort of looks at Western responses to that. Whereas what we see, particularly from China and also from Russia, is a similar concern, but an against Western hegemony concern. So a concern that the West has been using some of their control over key nodes in the economy and have been weaponizing those. And so we can see that about the use of the internet, for example. And so China sort of balkanized itself with the internet much earlier. We can see that strongly with concerns about the US dollar and SWIFT and the way in which the US has been able to use that. And so there we see not a kind of poor, weak non-Western states, but actually some of the stronger non-Western states saying, we push back and we don't take this as being fair. And you're sort of securitizing this in a way, but that's because you yourself are sort of abusing your position. So we think you see different things in different parts of the world, different classes within different parts of the world, but also a different emphasis in the stories. The other thing, though, that you will see is that some of the movements that have happened since we finished the book have actually been kind of parallel in different countries. So we've seen both the US and China increasingly develop their own geoeconomic narratives and increasingly move towards some technological bifurcation. But we've also seen both of them crack down on big tech, which is really a crackdown on corporate power. And so you're starting to see some really interesting configurations, I think, in China, where you've got some of this not just of pushback against the US geoeconomic and anti-Western hegemony narratives, but a very strong attempt to try to redress some of the inequality and some of the corporate power. But interestingly, that is also overlaying with some of what I would think of as more cultural right-wing populist ideas, which aren't so much the anti-immigration ideas, but are about those sort of strong traditional values. And so at the same stage as we see kind of a pushback against big tech in China, we also see a pushback against like sissy boys and people like men not being manly. And that sort of sense of manliness is something that also comes through in your right-wing protectionist narrative. And it's an unusual alliance from a US perspective to see that kind of strong left-wing inequality with that sort of cultural right-wing anti-sissy boy approach.
If I just may add something to that, so we were acutely conscious of the fact that we, of course, cover the Western perspectives much more in depth than the non-Western perspective, though at one point when we submitted the book to the publisher, in fact, it actually had four chapters on non-Western narratives, and we were then asked to cut that down a bit. So it ended up becoming just one chapter, but there was a lot more research that we did on the non-Western narratives than is actually showing up in the book. And for me, what was particularly interesting, looking particularly at Russia, was first that, of course, from Russia's perspective, the story of globalization is a completely different one. The moment of the greatest triumph of the West in the early 1990s is, from Russia's perspective, the moment of tragedy, not primarily because of the end of communism, but because of the downfall of the Soviet Union, and suddenly you had the state falling apart, as Putin put it, hundreds of thousands of people waking up in a foreign country suddenly. And so the starting point is a very different one. And then the experience of the 1990s is essentially one that the Western solutions don't work for Russia as well as they work in the West. And look, if you look further at the Russian narrative, the core charge that's often leveled against the West is one of hypocrisy. So what was striking to us when we looked at Putin's speeches, but also of writing of Russian political scientists, was this frustration that the West was promulgating all these rules and talking about the international rule of law. And then when it actually was something that would have constrained the United States or Western countries, for example, in imposing sanctions, then it was just jettisoned and not respected anymore. And so this charge of hypocrisy is something that developed into a full-blown narrative against Western hegemony, right? So it was an attempt to establish an order which is no longer dominated by the West. But we're fully conscious that in the book, we don't fully develop that narrative as much as it deserves to be developed. And so that's actually something for a future project, potentially, where we would have to obviously work with people who have a much better understanding of the local political systems and the local conversation than we do.
And I just add one other thing there. You also see there are different types of globalization. And so, for example, the US, some of the concerns at the moment are often about security or often about domestic workers. One of the things that was quite striking in some of the research we did on some of the narratives we saw coming up in Africa was the level of focus on cultural globalization, and that just the cultural products from places like the US, whether it was Levi jeans or Hollywood, would just engulf and overwhelm the local culture. And that's something that you just don't see as much concern about in America, because they're on the strong side of that. And so I think it's another example that sort of globalization looks different to different people in different places, because you have different experiences of that, and also because you have a different relationship to the particular story.
So I think I have kind of one more question before we wrap up our very interesting conversation. I guess, what are some of the broader implications of your approach, beyond just globalization? Kind of how does thinking about narratives allow us to understand other kind of complicated political problems?
One thing that was striking in the process of writing the book is the moment when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, because what we observed at the time is that the narratives that we had been analyzing suddenly all became narratives about the pandemic, right? So the left-wing populist narrative had its prescription for what should be done. For example, it said, well, we obviously now it's clear that we have to do more to provide health insurance to everyone and paid leave to everyone, because otherwise it's a danger to society. The right-wing populists suddenly said, oh, of course, now it shows that we have to have borders. We have to close the borders in order to not let the virus come in, right? The geo-economic narrative said, oh, this proves our point that we can't depend on China for personal protective equipment. So what was really interesting that is that we could almost predict the arguments that each of these narratives was going to make about this new political problem.
And I think it was also a really good example for us of what we think of as kaleidoscopic complexity. So I think of this project as, on one level, about being about economic globalization. But on another level, it is about how to understand and intervene in highly complex fields, and economic globalization just being one example of that. And one of the things that this multi-perspective analysis trains you to do is to look at complex issues from different perspectives. And so when it came to the COVID one, not only were we sort of able to predict what different ones were likely to say, but it meant that we were able to sort of see in the round from a more kaleidoscopic scope. We almost used the narratives to turn this particular issue from multiple directions and understand some of the different concerns that were likely to come up, and in fact ended up coming up in the next 18 months after that. And so I think it can be a useful policy tool for sort of encouraging you to look at things from different perspectives. I also think it's a useful policy tool in terms of thinking about integrative policymaking. So one of the things we've seen in the 20th century is a real push towards dividing and disaggregating and to specializing. And we see this in the universities with different disciplinary departments. We see this in government with different departments with different subject matter focuses. And one of the things you really see with these complex problems is a collision of different subject areas coming together, different actors, different approaches. You cannot understand them through a single subject matter focus. You cannot understand them through a single disciplinary focus. And this is something that we struggle to deal with both in a university context and also in a government context. And you can see this, for example, in the latest Economist, that the head trade person is really talking about how trade used to be seen as more isolated, and now it's trade and climate, trade and security, trade and workers' rights, trade and all sorts of other issues about the environment and various things, and sort of describes it as this complex mosaic. So this is really going to start to change the way in which we not only need to produce knowledge in universities, but also the way that we need to create more integrative approaches to policymaking. And if you think of two or three of the big challenges that are facing us going forward, we have a huge challenge about climate change, which is inherently a wicked problem of this nature. We have a huge problem about geopolitical rivalry, which is also a highly complex problem. And we have a huge problem about sort of inequality in various different ways. And if you could imagine that all of those need these multi-perspective approaches and these integrative approaches, but what we're coming to is actually a collision of these different wicked problems, I think one of the broader takeaways we take from the book is towards how do we think in these more integrative ways, to how do we encourage greater synthesis, how do we engage in multiple perspective taking and try to understand differences so that we move away from not just some of the silos that we see in our current workforce and our debates, but also some of the polarization that we see in those to try and find better pathways forward.
If I can add like a final comment to that, one of the really rewarding experiences of writing the book was that as we were looking into each narrative, we started to see merit to some extent in each narrative. So we often ask, which is the narrative that you prefer? And the answer is, well, we may have certain sympathies and find that certain narratives are more plausible, but we actually think there's truth in each of them, and none has the whole truth. And so that's something that we highly recommend others do as well, as they confront these difficult and complex problems. Just put themselves into the shoes of their opponents. And even if they don't end up agreeing with their perspective, it will give them, I think, a better understanding and a deeper appreciation for the underlying issues. And it also helps, as Anthea said, to hopefully overcome some of the polarization. So they're both analytical as well as normative benefits for taking these different perspectives. You understand the complex problem much better, but you also understand those who may be your opponents in the debate much better.
So with that, thank you for listening to our interview with Anthea Roberts and Nicholas Lamp, authors of Six Faces of Globalization, Who Wins, Who Loses, and Why It Matters. I do actually have one more question for the both of you. And that is, where can people find your work and what's next for you?
Okay, where can people find our work? So I've put up information about this book and also other books on a personal website now at AntheaRoberts.com. So you can find out more information there. In terms of what's next for me, I'm thinking very much about thinking about thinking. So the project I'm working on at the moment is called Thinking Global, which is actually what I was working on when this particular project came around. And it's about how do we think not just about global issues, but how do we start to try and think in these more global ways? So I'm particularly interested in ideas like complexity, in synthesis, in integration, but I'm also really interested in some of the underlying asymmetries of power about what sort of information gets out and what doesn't, and also some of the cross-border sort of intellectuals that I think are some of the most creative going forward. And when I say cross-border, I don't just mean cross-national borders. I also mean cross-disciplinary borders, cross-academic practice divides. So I think that's the direction that I'm working in at the moment, a project of thinking global.
And you can find my work on my webpage, which is essentially on my on the Queen's Faculty of Law homepage. I have all my articles linked there. And most of my work until this project was about multilateral trade lawmaking. And that's also my next project, is to explore the implications of all these narratives for multilateral trade negotiation and the future of the World Trade Organization. And so one aspect that I'm focusing on is the fact that these narratives bring new values into the trade space, resilience, sustainability, preserving communities, addressing inequality. And the question that we're all facing when we're thinking about the future of the multilateral trading system is this something that can be the subject of international negotiations? And we immediately see that there are real problems there. For example, many issues such as national security that countries are emphasizing much more often are regarded as non-negotiable. Others are raised really difficult distributive questions, which may cause countries to opt out of the current rules. And we see that already with the United States and China, that the United States is pursuing its policy, trade policies against China, virtually completely outside the multilateral system. And others pose collective challenges, such as addressing climate change and addressing, for example, the supply chain disruptions caused by the pandemic, where WTO members really would have to work together in a way that they've never worked together before. And so the scope for trade negotiations in the way that they've traditionally been conducted has diminished quite a bit. And there's a real question of whether the WTO and the multilateral trading system more broadly will be able to address these questions in some kind of cooperative fashion, or whether we'll just see more unilateral action taken by WTO members to address these new priorities that they have identified.
And this is an example of what we think of more broadly as governing and complexity. And we see this happening in trade, we see this happening in security, we see it happening in the environment.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. The Asian Review Books podcast is on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends if you want to continue to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Gershom Gorenberg, author of War of Shadows, Codebreakers, Spies, and the Secret Struggle to Drive the Nazis from the Middle East. But before then, thank you so much, Anthea and Nicholas, for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much, Nicholas.